I want to read you two scriptures. The first is from 1 Corinthians. It's on page 1383 in my Bible. 1 Corinthians chapter 12. And just the last part of one verse. You see verse 31, the last verse? Just the last bit of it. Paul says, "And yet show I unto you a way of more surpassing excellence." And a verse in Matthew. Matthew's Gospel, chapter 7, page 1154, my Bible. We talked about this a little bit in the reading. Verse 24, Matthew 7. "Whoever therefore hears these my words," this is Jesus speaking, "and does them, I will liken him to a prudent man who built his house upon the rock. And the rain came down, and the streams came, and the winds blew, and fell upon that house. And it did not fall, for it had been founded upon the rock. And everyone who hears these my words and does not do them, he shall be likened to a foolish man who built his house upon the sand. And the rain came down, and the streams came, and the winds blew, and beat upon that house, and it fell. And his fall was great. And it came to pass, when Jesus had finished these words, the crowds were astonished at his doctrine, for he taught them as having authority and not as their scribes." Go back to Corinthians now, where we started, please. Paul says, "Yet show I unto you a way of more surpassing excellence." I don't think that's really too hard to understand as a phrase. You all know what excellence is, don't you? I'm sure some of you have had this experience at school, where the teacher's called you over when he's been marking your homework. And he said, "This is good. In fact, it's excellent." Did you do it yourself? Excellent is better than good. It's better than very good. It's sort of somewhere over there on the spectrum of being the very, very best. And Paul is writing to some Christians 2,000 years ago in Corinth. And he's saying to them, "I don't just want to talk to you about something that's excellent. I want to talk to you about something that surpasses that. It's better than excellent." And the phrase just caught me. Stayed with me. He says to them, "I want to show you a way of more surpassing excellence." He's just been writing to this Christian company in Corinth. And they've had all sorts of problems. And you can see up the page, he's been explaining to them how they're put together as a body and they need to work together. And then he goes on to say, verse 28, that in their company, in their assembly, God has put apostles and prophets and teachers and miraculous powers and gifts of healings and so on. And then he says, "Are you all apostles? Are you all prophets? Are you all teachers?" And he ends with saying, "Well, these are all gifts from God. And you should desire them. You should want them." He says, "But I've got something even better that you should want. A way of surpassing excellence, which is better than all these things." I can't remember. Someone can tell me afterwards what language this was originally written in. Greek, maybe. I don't know what it was. It's been translated into English. But you look at the start of the next chapter. Even after translating it from a language 2,000 years ago into English, it's still excellent. There's a poetry to what he writes, apart from anything else. But there's a meaning to what he writes, which is just, it's been read at weddings. It's been read at state occasions. It's been read millions of times across the world since Paul first put the words down. Just listen to them. "I show unto you a way of more surpassing excellence. If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am become a sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophecy and know all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. And if I shall dole out all my goods in food, and if I deliver up my body that it may be burned, but have not love, I profit nothing. Love has long patience, love is kind. And so he goes on. Just in itself, this is excellent. Surpassingly excellent. This is Paul explaining to them something which is incredibly good. But I want you to read it for a different reason, just for a moment. Just cast your eyes down his list and think of Jesus Christ. Think of him. Look at the list. Jesus spoke with something better than the tongues of men and of angels. He was the Son of God himself. He was a man who's God's son. Somebody listening to Jesus 2,000 years ago wasn't just listening to an angel. They were listening to someone who was higher than that. They were listening to someone who was God's son. If I speak with the tongue of men or of angels but have not love, I'm a sounding brass or clanging cymbal. And then you look at Christ. Right, he is the picture of love. It just is. Not many people dispute that. Even people who don't believe in him, people who say he's a myth, will still agree with you that Jesus shows love. It just does. People sometimes want to do the things that Jesus did, behave like him without having to believe in him, because he's good. If I have prophecy and know all mysteries and all knowledge. If I have prophecy and know all mysteries and all knowledge. Have you read the things that Jesus talked about? Have you read the way they used to come to him with their clever questions? And Jesus used to say, actually, it's not like that. In heaven, it's like this. And he said it with an authority that silenced them, because he knew what he was talking about. And he was talking about a place that he had come from. And they were only trying to imagine. He talked with knowledge. If I dole out my goods in food, if I deliver up my body. He who was rich became poor. He offered his own body as a sacrifice. And Paul says, it profited nothing if it had not been done with love. But it was, wasn't it? You can see it. That's all I wanted to say about that. I show unto you a way of more surpassing excellence. Now just have a look at this for a minute. John's Gospel, chapter 11. John 11. Show I unto you a way of more surpassing excellence. John's Gospel, chapter 11, is the story of Lazarus at Bethany. It's a very famous story. I've heard people who aren't Christians talk about it's like the raising of Lazarus. People know what happened. But to John, who wrote it down here in his gospel, it wasn't just a story. It was something he'd seen. You see, John was called, the person who wrote this gospel, he was called by Jesus to follow him. And he did follow him for the rest of his life. But in those first 3 years as John followed him, he saw things that no one ever expected to see. Healings, mainly. Healings. Have you read the Gospels? Have you ever, Luke in particular, Luke's Gospel, that doctor who wrote a Gospel, have you ever read it and let the healing after healing after healing after healing after healing come home to you? And then you read the paragraphs that say things like, as Jesus came from village to village with his disciples, they would lay out the sick in the marketplaces, it says, so that he might touch them or speak a word and heal them. As he entered the village, there would the sick be, ready. Oh, John has seen healing like you and I can hardly imagine, but we can read it. Lepers, blind, lame, dumb, bleeding. Any illness you can think of, John has seen them healed. Jesus' healing was excellent. But here in this chapter, I think he surpasses all of that. You read the way John writes the story. John starts by saying Lazarus was sick at the beginning of chapter 11. And then he tells you that Lazarus' sisters, Martha and Mary, they sent a message to Jesus saying, come, we need your help. Lazarus is sick, he's dying. And as many people have seen over the years, Jesus does the one thing that you don't expect. He stays put. He doesn't come. You've heard, probably most of you, gospel preaching after gospel preaching, where the preacher's told you, Jesus says, come. He's ready. He'll save you. He wants you to come. Well, look at this story. It's the other way around. They say, Jesus, please come to us. And he stays 2 days where he is, quite deliberately. And then he sets off to go to them. And his disciples say, it's dangerous where they are. The people are hunting you. They want your life. Bethany is just outside Jerusalem. You shouldn't go. He says, we're going. And he arrives 4 days after Lazarus has died. And John tells the story that, verse 17 there, Jesus therefore on arriving found him to have been 4 days already in the tomb. And in verse 20, Martha heard that Jesus was coming and she went to meet him. So the dead man's sister went to meet Jesus. And she says to him, Lord, verse 21, if you'd been here, my brother wouldn't have died. We sent to you for help. If you'd been here, he wouldn't have died. And Jesus has a conversation that I don't think Martha understood at the time. He says to Martha, your brother will rise again. And Martha says, yes, I know he will. In the resurrection at the last day. Great. But right now he's dead. He's gone. You didn't come. Jesus says to her, I am the resurrection and the life. He that believes on me, although he have died, shall live. And everyone who lives and believes on me shall never die. Do you believe this? And she says to him, yes, Lord. I believe that you're the Christ, the Son of God, who should come into the world. I don't know what she understood then. She was about to learn something that she didn't expect. She goes and finds her sister Mary, and Mary comes and says exactly the same thing to Jesus. Verse 32 at the bottom of the page. She fell at his feet saying, Lord, if thou hadst been here, if you'd been here, my brother wouldn't have died. So Jesus was deeply moved in spirit and he was troubled. And he says, where have you put him? And they say, Lord, come and see. And Jesus wept. The Jews looked and they said, look, look how he loved him. And some of them said, I'm reading it to you. This is John's account. Some of them said, couldn't this man who's opened the eyes of the blind, couldn't he have caused that this man also should not have died? And Jesus heard them. And it says, John says, he was deeply moved. Couldn't he have saved him? And then they come to the tomb. And John says it was a cave and a stone lay upon it. And I don't know what you think when you read these verses in John 11. But I see no expectation whatsoever that Jesus is about to do something. I just see a lack of hope. He'd come too late. He was a great healer. And he could have healed. They were sure about that. But he'd come too late. And there was no hope. No expectation that he could do anything. You can see it. Jesus says, verse 39, take away the stone. Martha says, the sister of the dead, she says, Lord, no. It stinks. It smells. He's been 4 days dead in this hot climate. You can't go in there. You can't go into the tomb. Jesus had no intention of going into the tomb. He says, didn't I say to you that if you believe, you'll see the glory of God? So they took away the stone and the tomb was opened. And there in front of that open tomb, John says, Jesus lifted up his eyes on high. Maybe you pray with your eyes shut. Maybe you pray with your eyes shut and somehow looking down. A lot of us do that. Seems Jesus here was probably praying with his eyes open and looking up. And he was speaking quite clearly to somebody he knew. You might think of your God as far away. You might think of God as being incredibly distant. But you read sometimes the things that Jesus said when he prayed. He just spoke to his own Father. He says, Father, thank you. I thank thee that thou hast heard me. And he says a few other things. And then, having said this, verse 43, he cried with a loud voice, saying, Lazarus, come forth. Lazarus, come out. I sometimes try and put myself here, in Bethany, in the cemetery, in front of the tomb, at that moment where Jesus says, Lazarus, come out. And I wonder if it just was a gasp and a silence as they wonder at what he's doing. I think they thought he was going into the tomb and they said, don't, because of the smell. He wasn't going into the tomb. He called the dead man and said, come out. And then to their astonishment, out he came. John saw it. John says it looked like this. The dead man came out, bound, feet and hands still with grave clothes. His face was bound round with a handkerchief, John says. Jesus says to them, loose him and let him go. And then the story goes on. You'll find people had difficulty with believing that this had happened. But there he was. What greater evidence could you have? The man who had been dead was living again in Bethany. If you wanted to, you could go out from Jerusalem to see him. What was the answer of the religious authorities? Well, let's kill him again. Scripture doesn't say they ever did, but they certainly planned to. Let's kill him again. I sometimes wonder what, not so much what Lazarus thought, but what Martha and Mary thought. They'd heard about healings. They'd maybe seen them. This surpassed them all. Their brother was dead, and Jesus called him out of death, and he came back. It's superlative. It's excellent. It's the ultimate in healings. He'd gone beyond sickness and disease and he had died. And Jesus called him back. Lazarus, come on out. If you wanted to scale, and this is simply my point, of the healings. You know, from the little things like he healed. Well, it's not little to me, I couldn't do it. He healed Simon Peter's mother-in-law from a fever. Do you remember that? Right up to touching lepers and making blind see. And then off the scale is this healing where the dead are raised. It's excellence. I'll show you a way of excellence, Paul wrote later. A way of surpassing excellence. And then Jesus went one step further. And he did the inconceivable. All the gospel writers tell you this. I'll tell you the story. I'm not going to make you turn to it. I don't know how long it was after the raising of Lazarus. I find it hard to tell. But there was a Sunday morning when some women who were Jesus' friends were coming to a tomb outside Jerusalem. His tomb. He'd been dead. It's difficult to tell how long. If he died on the Friday, this was the Sunday morning, he'd been dead quite a while. Some people think perhaps he died earlier in the week. It's difficult to tell. But he was dead and he'd been dead a while. There was no Jesus this time to stand outside his tomb and call him out. And the women who came to the tomb came without any hope of that. They didn't believe the apostles, Peter or John, or any of their friends could stand in front of the tomb now and summon Jesus from death. They didn't believe that. And they were right not to. It wasn't going to happen. So they came to the tomb as early as they could on the day after Sabbath. And they came to embalm, or whatever the right word is, put ointment on his body. It's all they could do. And as they came to the tomb in the early hours of that Sunday morning, there were angels waiting. Just like Lazarus' tomb, the stone was already rolled away. And there was no body. Someone was waiting with a message that would say, he's not here. He's risen. Come, he said, come. Come and see the place where he lay. He's not here. I'll show you a way of more surpassing excellence. More excellent than the thing that happened in Bethany. This thing that happened in Jerusalem at that tomb. I'll show you. Come and look. He's not here. He's risen. Why is that greater than the raising of Lazarus? Why is it more excellent? Why does it surpass it? Lazarus could do nothing. Lazarus was utterly helpless in death. Jesus said, I have authority to lay down my life, and I have authority to take it again. You can read different accounts and see it how you like. They were all involved. He was raised by his Father, God himself. He took his life again, depending how you read the accounts. There was no man at the entrance to the tomb summoning him out. This was a man who was dead, breaking death by coming back. It's surpassingly excellent. You see those words that I read to you in Corinthians? Don't bother to turn back to it. Paul says, I will show to you a way of more surpassing excellence. If these things are done, but there's no love, there's no point to them. If you speak with the tongues of men and angels, or if you prophesy, or if you have knowledge of mysteries and other things, or if you give out all your goods in food, or if you deliver your body up to be burned, there's no profit in it unless you love. Lots of people have said this, but I do think about it from time to time. I think, what would I have written across the top of the cross? Pilate said, I want you to write the King of the Jews. And they wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews, across the top of the cross, so that anybody standing looking on that afternoon or that morning at the cross would see the charge across the top. I wonder what John would have written, the Apostle John, if he'd been asked to write the words. Because many years later, he says, herein is love. That God gave his Son as a propitiation for our sins. In this is love, John says. He says, look at this cross. This is love. What's love? Love is, we've talked about it before. Love is that warm feeling inside you feel for somebody else. Love is the affection that you feel. Love is the things that you do for other people. But John, love can be romantic. It can be family. It can be all sorts of things, friends. But John says, this shows you love like nothing else ever will. Mm-hmm. If you would just look at this cross. In this is love that God gave his Son. A propitiation, what does that mean? It means he gave him as a sacrifice that is available to everybody. The Bible tells you not everybody will come and take that sacrifice for themselves. But it is, for the moment, available, John says, to everybody. And this is love. Love is a way of surpassing excellence. The message from the cross defies the words that any preacher can find. You just look at the cross for yourself quietly. Do it now if you like. Do it quietly when you're alone. Just look at that cross. See if you see love. This is a self-sacrificing, giving love like no one has ever seen. I'll show you a way of surpassing excellence. John could say that. I'll show you the cross. Now I want you to look at Matthew, where I read in Matthew 7. This is written by another of Jesus' disciples. He's recording the words that Jesus spoke. We talked about them this afternoon. These words come at the end of several pages of Jesus' teaching, of what is known as the Sermon on the Mount. And I'm not going to take you through it. But Jesus sat on a hillside nearly 2,000 years ago, tells you that, and he taught. And this is how he finished what he'd been teaching. He said, I'll tell you a story about a man who built a house on a rock. And the storms came and the waters came and the house stood. It held firm. Its foundations were secure because they were on a rock. And I'll tell you a story about a man who built a house on a sand and it looked just as good. But when troubles came, when the streams came and the waters came, they swept under the house and it collapsed. And we all understand that. It's a great picture, like many of the stories Jesus tells. A simple picture that stays with you and you understand. My local brethren aren't here, so I can say this. But I used this with them a few weeks ago in the preaching. And I have no apology for using it again. But when I was a small boy, my parents would take us fossil hunting. There's several places around the Kent coast where you can collect fossils. They're all on the beach, the ones we went to. And this is a bit sensitive if Ollie's there when you say it, but the best place we found was at Sheppey, just along from Sheerness at Minster. You could get really good little dark fossil shark's teeth. And once we found this tree trunk with, you might not think this is very nice, but it had fossilised worms in it, loads of them, and they were bright orange, and they were hard as can be, right? I don't know how many thousands of years old they were. Fantastic. The school took it. They kept it in the biology department for a while. But one day we were there, and we were fossil hunting, and my little brother wandered a bit further out, and it's not really sand at Sheppey, it's mud. And he started to sink. It's maybe a bit afraid of beaches at times. Ever since, I remember him sinking. He was wearing Wellington boots, and they went down. And it wasn't dramatic. We pulled him out. I think he left one boot behind. We couldn't get it out. It went down. Sinking sand. You know, sometimes life's like that. I'm walking on the floor. Here, look. I'm not expecting to go down. It's hard. When you're walking on that sand, sometimes you find your feet aren't so steady, and you're sucked down. We were on a beach at North Somerset last year, and I was doing the same thing, collecting shells and fossils, and I walked across a patch of sand and it turned out it was mud, and I started to go down. Now, I'm sure I wouldn't have gone down far, but what you do immediately is you look around for the nearest rock. That's what you do, and you make your way to the rock, and as soon as you're on the rock, you are safe. It's the imagery that Jesus used. You're safe on a rock. Life's like that too. Have you ever noticed how much life changes? The older you get, the more you notice this. Nothing stays the same forever. Nothing. So we were driving along a street in Sevenoaks yesterday, and I just sort of sitting there reflecting on this, not for this preaching. I said, this street is so familiar. In a few months' time, we'll have lived in that town for 50 years. And yet, as you drive along, when we first came, that building wasn't here, and that building wasn't here, and that garage wasn't here, and I've never heard a Quick Fit. It's very familiar, and yet it's changed so much. The trees, they were there, but they were smaller. And then you see, as you look around, even if you look in your back garden, over the years, everything constantly changes. A lot of the time, that's fine. We like variety. We like change. We don't want boredom. But sometimes in your life, things change, but you don't want them to. You all know that. When you're young, sometimes being young is great. You've got life ahead. At least you think you have. I remember being a teenager. They were good years. Sometimes you'd wonder who your first girlfriend would be. Sometimes you'd wonder whether you'd ever get married. who it would be. But that turned out okay. You wonder what you might get for your first car. You wonder what you might get as a job. That turned out okay too. You wonder if you might one day have children as you get a bit older. And you wonder what your children will be like. I remember before James was born, walking around in my lunch hour in London one day, in the city, and thinking, in a few months' time, that little baby will be here. I'm going to meet my son. I wonder what it would be like. Life can be good. And the changes are good. But other times in your life, things go wrong. When the doctors say to you, and some of you have had this, maybe all of you, the doctors say to you, this is the problem, this is what we're going to do about it. And you go, yeah, I can understand that, that's good, that's sensible. But don't eat those foods again, ever. And you think, I like them. And just for a moment, it feels like life's a tiny bit out of control. Like the ground beneath your feet's moving and you don't want it to. Or maybe you'll sit in front of a doctor and he'll say, that pain that you get that stops you in your tracks, that's your heart. We'll treat it like this, okay? And part of your mind goes, yeah, good. And part of you thinks, I can't do anything about this. It's as if the ground has moved again under your feet. Or bluntly, if you have a fit and your mind goes, you find you can't see and you can't think. What's this all about? And they say, well, you can't drive now. Not for a long time. And you go, yeah, I understand that. That's sensible. And I understand what you're doing. It's not a big deal. But part of you think, my feet are slipping. I'm not in control. I imagine as you get older, you get more and more of that. You feel like you're on standing on sand. You're standing on ground which isn't solid. You're standing on ground which always changes. And you're not in control of it. And you just want to stand on solid ground and keep life the same forever. You can't do it. Except Jesus says you can. He told this story about a man who built his life on solid ground. He built his life upon a rock. Sometimes I've been in meetings where people say, well, what do you have to do to build it? You don't need to ask that question. Because Jesus has just told you. As Chris told us in the reading. Jesus says, whoever therefore hears these my words and does them, I will liken him to a prudent or a wise man who built his house upon the rock. Whoever hears these my words and does them, he's like a man who's building his house upon a rock. He's building on something stable. He's got something that will last when troubles come. In Matthew's words, for it had been founded upon the rock. Whoever hears these my words and does them. What words? Which words? There's 5 pages of words from Jesus. Well, in a way, all of them. Every word of Jesus is there for you and me to read and learn from and do. But this is just what he'd just been saying before he told the story. It's only just over the page. Jesus said to them, enter in through the narrow gate. For wide the gate and broad the way that leads to destruction. And many are they who enter in through it. Narrow the gate, straighten the way that leads to life. And they are few who find it. Jesus says, whoever hears these my words and does them. Whoever, Jesus says, enters in through whatever this narrow gate is, they'll find a way that leads to life. narrow gate. And now, all these years later, we hardly need to explain to each other what the narrow gate is, do we? Because we know. The question isn't, do we know it? The question is, have we done it? A narrow gate. The broad gate is the way of life that many people go on together. This gate that he describes is so narrow, that only lets one person in at a time. I can't go to one of my friends and say, let's go together to Jesus. If you go, I go. I don't especially recommend that. The way Jesus puts it is you come on your own. On your own. Luke's Gospel, the same verses as we noted in the reading. He starts with not just whoever hears my words and does them, but whoever comes to me and hears my words and does them, Jesus says. And there you have it. It's a narrow gate. In my heart, I've been to Jesus. No question about it. I know. I'm at peace about this, totally. So are many others in this room. I've been to Jesus in my heart, and I've recognised what the scripture says, that this is God's Son. And that sacrifice on the cross, and that blood that was shed, is God's offer to me. There is no way for me to get peace with God. There is no way for me to get my sins forgiven. There is no way for me to avoid hell. There is no way for me to go to heaven. Except by coming to Jesus and asking him to forgive me my sins. And to let that sacrifice, please, Lord, on the cross, let that be for me. That's all God ever demands as a way to heaven. This is what God asks of every human being. Recognize that this is my Son. See who this is. Doesn't take more than a few seconds. Hear that voice that speaks to your heart. Not my voice. Hear that witness from the Spirit to your heart. Hear it. And then answer it. That voice that says this really is true. This is God's Son. This is Jesus. This is the proof. This is the beginning and the end of the story. Jesus Christ, God's Son. He's the Saviour for sinners. That means that as soon as you turn in your heart and you say to him, please forgive me, let your sacrifice be for me, he forgives. How much faith do you need? Jesus says, just so that you're not in any doubt. Faith like a grain of mustard seed. The tiniest, minutest amount of faith anybody could ever imagine. Just enough to turn your heart and speak to Jesus and ask for that forgiveness. That's all you need. Now I've got one more verse for you. It's in the Psalms. Psalm 61, I think. It's on page 727. It's a Psalm of David, Psalm 61. To the chief musician, on a stringed instrument, a Psalm of David, King David. Hear, O God, my cry. Attend unto my prayer. From the end of the earth will I call unto thee. When my heart is overwhelmed, thou wilt lead me onto a rock which is too high for me. If you've got the same Bible as me, look at the note. Thou wilt lead me onto a rock which is too high for me. Could be read, note H, which is higher than I. David is saying, in a time of trouble, it's a picture to easy to understand. He's using words, but he's painting a picture with words. He's saying, in a time of trouble, when I'm overwhelmed, lift me up. To his God, years before Jesus came, he's praying to his God, and he's saying, when I'm overwhelmed, when I'm in trouble, lift me up. Let me stand on a rock that I can't reach at the moment. In my head, when I read these words, I almost see a picture of Jesus reaching down and saying, come on up. Think about this for a minute, and then I'll finish. Right? How do we decide what's right and wrong? In the world generally, how do we decide? Well, it seems to me today, we decide sometimes by a vote. If the majority thinks something is right, then that's what's right. And if 20 years later the majority think the opposite is right, then that's what's right. Or we do it by pressure group. So a small minority thinks something is right, and they're vociferous about it. And they make a lot of noise, and eventually everybody goes, well, that must be right. And we decide what's right and wrong that way. some things that Christians do, are now called immoral. Wrong. Some beliefs that Christians have are just, on a majority vote, considered wrong. Doesn't satisfy me very much. If right and wrong can be decided on a vote, and can be changed on a vote, if it depends on public whim, doesn't satisfy me very much. I want to stand on higher ground. I want to stand where Jesus stands. I'd like to see things the way Jesus sees things. I read what he taught. I'd like to see things the way he saw them then. I'd like to see things today the way he sees them now. I think that's what David's writing about. He wanted to stand on higher ground. Not just solid ground that doesn't move, standing on the rock that is Christ and his work. That gives you certainty. But now I want to stand on higher ground and see things as Jesus sees them. The little things in life, the relationships, the problems, the how to deal with things, the bigger issues. I just want to see it how Jesus sees it. I want to stand on higher ground. And God's invitation to you tonight is come to Jesus and get your sins forgiven. Come in through the narrow gate and find peace. Stand for the rest of your life on a rock, not on sinking sand, on ground that moves. Whatever troubles that come to you, you can keep Jesus. And keep him to the end and through the end and forever. And God's invitation to you too is to follow him in your life, to do the things that he asked, the things that he taught. Not just hear his words, but do them. Until you find you're seeing things the way he sees them. Finished.